Good morning. I'm Carrie Connor, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Zahersky. I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, please. The brief in this case addresses a very narrow issue, and that is whether or not the court erred first in finding a waiver of the issue for resentencing on Section 2G1.3D. Specifically, and we agree that the defendant, through counsel on appeal, had not previously raised that specific provision. However, when this court found that there was error in the district court's decision in finding an application of enhancement under 2G1.3B, that finding clearly affected the findings in the 2G1.3D finding. And specifically, the ruling that it had to be a minor in order for there to be undue influence resulted in the court actually finding in its appellate opinion that Holly, the so-called chat with the individual named Holly, that there was no proof that Holly was a minor, that there was no proof that a meeting had taken place. Those two findings by the appellate court are inextricably connected with the finding under 2G1.3D.
Why does it matter whether Holly is a minor? I mean, usually the so-called minors in these cases are police officers pretending to be minors. That obviously does not exonerate the defendant. So why isn't it enough that he thought Holly was a minor and he was very eager to meet her, just as with the undercover agents?
So another way of filling out that question is why doesn't the definition of minor in Application Note 1 to this guideline apply to the subpart D? Because under this definition, Part B is an individual, whether fictitious or not. So it seems to sweep in fictitious minors.
Well, I believe, though, that the way the definition reads is that, first of all, there has to be a finding that the defendant believed she was 14. Secondly, if she's not a minor,
that's easy given the transcript. She says that.
Yeah. Well, I would beg to differ. And one of the problems that we have ongoing in these cases is the concept of these fantasy discussions. We also don't have a meeting with Holly. There's no evidence of a meeting. And though there does not have to be an actual meeting for an attempt, there needs to be proof of a substantial step. The district court in this case never went to that theory. In fact, if the court looks to the discussion that's part of the government's appendix, which is at page 24, when the court makes its ruling on Holly, it clearly is finding that Holly was, in fact, a minor. It is not finding that Holly was fictitious or that Holly was some other person. We don't know whether Holly is a 50-year-old man, and we don't know whether or not this is actually part of a fantasy. It's the government's burden to prove those things. In fact, if we also look to the government's appendix, which they filed, AUSA Mr. Benson argued, in fact, that Holly was, in fact, a second minor. It specifically says that in his argument, and that's what the court adopted. Therefore, based on the finding in the appeal by this court, the court at a minimum should have allowed fact-finding regarding the application of this enhancement, which the court clearly precluded.
I don't understand that. It's perfectly clear that he thinks she's a minor. That's all you need.
Well, Your Honor, even if he thinks she's a minor, in order to prove an attempt under 2422, you need, if you don't have a meeting, obviously, or an attempt at a meeting, you need an analysis of the substantial step.
That's the substantive liability. This is the guideline that goes for these pseudo crimes, and I guess what I'm not sure of is why your theory is that if a fact overlaps between the part of the case that was remanded and a part of the case that had not been explored, that allows you to take a wedge approach to the remand and reopen everything for which that fact happens to play a role. I don't think we've said that.
I've seen my time is up. May I respond?
Please do, yeah.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the reason we have such a narrow appeal here, and actually a very narrow sentencing, is that because the facts found by the appellate court were so inextricably related to the 2G1.3D analysis, this is the only issue, in essence, that was raised in addition to that determined by the appellate court.
Well, that's a practical answer, and I do understand that. But as a legal matter, though, don't you think in the first appeal, if one of the facts that was going to be seen as critical is whether Holly was really a minor or not, was going to come up, you'd have to look through the guideline and raise everything for which that's pertinent?
Your Honor, if the court is asking me should it have been raised by that appellate counsel, yes, it should have been raised. It should have been raised.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Connor. Ms. Kirchhoff?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Emily Kirchhoff on behalf of the United States. As counsel noted, Mr. Zahirsky did not challenge the use of the pseudo count during his original appeal in 2008. So under this Court's precedent, that issue cannot now be raised, because any time an argument could have been raised on appeal but was not, that argument is deemed waived. Unlike some of the cases cited in the defendant's brief, specifically Schroeder, Mr. Zahirsky had a full and fair opportunity to present a challenge to the pseudo count at the time of the first appeal.
So, Ms. Kirchhoff, usually when somebody just fails to do something, we speak in terms of forfeiture in these precise times we live in, not waiver. So if this is a forfeiture, then it seems that he never stands up in the first appeal and says, I hereby forswear all other arguments under the guidelines I could make. So if it is a forfeiture, maybe we should look at it anyway, given the close relation between the two issues.
It is the government's position that this has been waived, and so therefore it is outside the scope of the remand, so the district court did not err in not.
Right, but it was our remand, and if it seems so close, why couldn't we reach it?
And that is certainly can be done, and it is the government's position that even under the merits,
I don't think you should say that. I think you should say, no, it can't be, because that would circumvent the limits on collateral attack, right? Because in effect, this, so far as raising an issue that wasn't raised in the first appeal and the second appeal, this is a collateral attack, right? And there are all sorts of limitations on collateral attacks. I would have thought that was the government's position. Maybe it isn't.
It is the government's position that this argument has been waived. Yes, I don't want to misstate that. However, if the court does look at the merits of the pseudo count, the district court was not incorrect in applying that pseudo count.
So why don't you have to prove for 2G1.3D that it really is a minor? It's not some police officer posing as a minor.
As you noted, Application Note 1 does define minor as either someone who is underage or an officer who is presenting himself or herself to be someone who is under the age, or is presenting that someone else who is underage can be used for the defendant. And here, there is evidence in the record that Holly either was 14 or it would have been reasonable for the district court to conclude that it was another undercover officer. As this court has noted, there are plenty of cases where officers pretend to be minors in these operations to find defendants who are searching for underage individuals.
The third possibility is that it's an adult, maybe not even female, who's just, playing around. People are constantly going online with fictitious personae, right?
That is a possibility.
Especially, it's very common, apparently, for men to go online and pretend to be women. So I suppose they can pretend to be girls.
That is a possibility. However, here, the district court only needed to find by a preponderance of the evidence that it was either a minor
or... Was there any evidence bearing on the question?
The chats with Holly, she represents herself as a 14-year-old. Mr. Zahersky never questioned that, and he also represented to Shelley, the victim of the substantive count, that he had contacted another 14-year-old female who had similar living situations to Shelley. But
if he thought she was a 14-year-old and she was, in fact, an adult who was not an undercover agent, then there wouldn't be a crime, would there be? There wouldn't be a crime.
If Holly was an adult
who's not an undercover agent.
Under the guidelines, the definition of minor is someone under the age of 14 or an officer, you know, representing
right. So
himself.
So it could easily be non-criminal activity, depending on how common this kind of impersonation is. Who knows? I mean, these are rather strange people. I don't know what they're...
And it is the government's position that, based on the evidence before the district court, it was reasonable to conclude that Holly was either a minor or an officer acting in an undercover capacity.
Any evidence, right?
The chats with Holly, where there is a representation that she is 14.
If there are people who go on the web and misrepresent who they are, then this might have been one of those people. There's nothing in here about whether that's common. Maybe it's very uncommon. But on the other hand, how many undercover officers do they have? Maybe there are relatively few undercover officers, but a great many people who enjoy impersonating young
very
girls.
True.
Pedophiles.
There yeah. is, when there are those fantasy situations where it is an adult posing as a 14-year-old, those chats usually start in a much different manner because the adult makes it very clear, you know, I am an adult. What age would you like for me to pretend to be? I think it sets up very clear guidelines from the beginning as to, you know, I will play the role that you want me to play. If there are no further questions, we ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kirkhoff. Ms. Connor, do you have anything further? Has your time expired?
Yes. Your Honor, I don't agree with Ms. Kirkhoff that we would know if this was a fictitious situation because everyone would clarify that from the beginning. We've seen in multiple cases related to the solicitation that, in fact, that is the quandary for this court when you're looking at a record to determine whether or not it's a fantasy conversation or not. And we especially run into that problem when there's no actual travel related to that conversation because we don't know whether it is play, even if it's play outside our individual personal experiences. But I do think...
Is there literature on this? I mean,
I think it's discussed in several of the enticement cases. I think Gladish touches on it. Shishulka touches on it. This idea that, though we haven't had an extensive research done on it that I'm aware of, that, in fact, this does go on the Internet. And, in fact, that the Internet offers a place where a grandmother of 68 can pretend she's a 14-year-old girl or a 50-year-old man can pretend she's a 14-year-old girl. And... I just would like to
probably be a bigger pretense if he pretended he was a 14-year-old boy.
Your Honor, to each their own, I think is the answer to that question. I do think it's important, though, that we focus on what the actual guideline definition of minor is, and it does either require proof of being underage or the involvement of a law enforcement officer. And who is in a better position to show that the chatter was a law enforcement officer than the federal government? And review of this case shows that that is simply absent from the record. And again, Your Honors, I would point out that same reference has been made in other solicitation cases where the government has not done that necessary research. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Connor. And you were appointed, weren't you?
Well,
and you're a defender. Okay, well, we thank the defenders and you particularly for your efforts on the law. And we thank Ms. Kirkhoff.